Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Hello, Teresa. Thank you.
It's so nice to start another show. We had a wonderful show last week talking about Pope St. Pius X.
That's right.
And the Sarto family and his beginnings.
Yeah.
I enjoyed listening to the rebroadcast of that program. And I'm sure that today, as we begin St. Benedict...
Not St. Benedict.
No. Pope Benedict. Right. That would go back, take us back a ways farther, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that certainly would. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very different experience.
This
papacy is going to be very different from the one of Pius X.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. Yeah. And it's not his fault.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Give a little disclaimer right from the beginning. Well, for all practical purposes, the 20th century began in 1914. They were living in an afterglow in the 19th century. As you come into the 20th century, there were certainly some big problems that were looming, but I don't think anyone could have predicted or would have predicted the horrors that came upon Europe and the world in 1914. In June 28th, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was on a state tour and a visit to the city of Sarajevo in Bosnia. And while he was there, his intention was to build closer bonds with the Bosnians. This region was being overseen by a mandate, and the Austro-Hungarian Empire was overseeing this area called Bosnia-Herzegovina. And his intention was to build closer relations between the Vienna government and the Bosnians, the what's called the South Slavs, mm-hmm. with the intention of eventually uniting them to the empire itself. The Austro-Hungarian Empire is a huge empire, 70 million people. It is a dual empire. It has a capital both in Vienna and also in Budapest. The Holy Roman Emperor, or at this point, for all practical purposes, we just have to call him the Austrian Emperor, is also the King of Hungary. And so it's a dual monarchy. Franz Ferdinand was looking at the possibilities of creating a triple monarchy and in creating this really huge country. All of his dreams and aspirations were dashed on that day, on June 28th. When a young terrorist by the name of Princeps jumped onto the running board of his car as the touring car and emptied his gun into the Archduke, killing him almost immediately. This young man was apprehended by the police and interrogated. It was discovered that he had links to an organization, a terrorist organization called the Black Hand. And this was a group of Slavs who wanted to see the extension of a large Slavic kingdom. One of their other names of this organization was Union or Death. And what they wanted to do was to use the country of Serbia and extend that to take over all of the South Slavs, that whole region, and to create a single united country. Ultimately, they'll succeed at the end of the Second World War, at the end of the First World War, Yugoslavia is created.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, within our own last decade, we've seen that that entity disintegrate back into its various parts. This was an incredible blow to the aspirations of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Everyone was looking forward to Franz Ferdinand becoming the next emperor, and nobody was looking forward to him becoming the next emperor more than the present emperor, his grandfather, the Emperor Franz Joseph. Franz Joseph had been on the throne, the Austrian throne, for 66 years.
Wow.
He took over in 1848 with the revolutions, 1849, with the revolutions. He became the emperor. He was just probably about 18 years old at the time, but he had been on the throne all that time, and just a life of absolute tragedy. One of his sons had committed suicide. Another of his progeny had gone off to Mexico to become the emperor of Mexico. You remember Maximilian? He was murdered by the Mexicans there. It's just a really tough life. And then here toward the end of his life, to have the apple of his eye gunned down on the streets of Sarajevo was just too much. Well, the response then is that the Austrian government demanded of the Serbian government certain concessions, and because they were able to trace this act not only to the Black Hand, but also a tie-in between the Black Hand and the Serbian secret police. And so the Austrians demanded the right to go into Serbia and into Belgrade itself, and to go through government records and files to look for further evidence. That would be, of course, a violation of sovereignty, national sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And so the Serbians refused to do that. And tensions grew very rapidly between the Serbians and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, the Serbs realized that they couldn't fight that huge empire like that, and so they turned to Russia for help, another big Slavic country. Russia had had always had a sense of obligation to care for the Slavs, and so they were more than happy to do that. Actually, the Russians had just finished off, within 10 years earlier, a very disastrous war against the Japanese, and in the Russo-Japanese War, and they were kind of looking for the opportunity to rattle some swords and get a couple
redeem
victories.
Themselves.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of redeem themselves. And so they agreed to defend Serbia, and they began mobilizing their army, which is a huge army in a huge country, of course. And as they did that, the Austrians realized that now they were on the receiving end, and so they turned to the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
They had a mutual defense pact with Germany, and the Germans tried to avoid war by threatening Russia. And what they said basically was, stop mobilizing. We'll work this thing out. But if you continue mobilizing, we have to respond by mobilizing too, because it takes so long for armies to gather up the steam. And once they've gathered up, then they have the opportunity of preemption. So all this is made complicated by the fact that there are two alliance systems that had developed in the late 19th century in Europe. One of those was the Triple Alliance, which actually, in actuality, became the Dual Alliance. Mm-hmm. This was between Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the competing alliance, which was more of a, not so much an alliance, but an understanding, was made up of Russia and France. And they had a mutual defense treaty, so that if one got attacked, the other one would consider that attack on themselves too. And then there's a third power also in this, but there was no treaty obligations, and that was Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So you have then on one side, sometimes it's referred to as the Central Powers, Germany, Austria, and Italy, and then the other powers, France, England, and Russia. So you can see how they're kind of being drawn into this. If there's going to be a conflict, it's going to be a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened. When the Russians did not demobilize, the Germans responded then by declaring war on Russia and then almost immediately declaring war on France, because they knew the French were going to come in anyway. This was on the 1st of August, 1914. Barbara Tuchman has written just the most incredible book. It's just really fun reading history. It's called The Guns of August, and it really describes all of this in great detail. Now, the Germans felt as though, especially if they were going to have to fight a war in which on you had an enemy on the west and an enemy on the east, you had to fight a war that would be very, very quick and get it over with quickly. Now, they had had a war with France once before, if you remember 1870, and that was a very quick war. They won that war in a matter of weeks, and then they ended up going on for another 11 months with the siege of Paris. But so this time around, they decided they were going to do the same thing, a very quick victory, a huge attack. And then this time, though, they were going to go for Paris. They were going to take Paris, and that would end the war in the West. Then they would turn all of their armies, by the time the Russians got around to mobilizing, march them off to the East, and they would be victorious. It's named after the general that came up with the idea. It's called the Schlieffen Plan.
Okay.
But to do this, he had to go through terrain that was neither French nor German. He had to march through Belgium, which is relatively flat. And so, right away, within the first day, 2 days of the war, the German army then launched an attack, a preemptive attack, across the Belgian plains, Luxembourg, and into France itself. 78 divisions.
Wow.
If they were up to full strength, that would be almost 780,000 men.
Wow.
There certainly were over 500,000 men in this one movement. Just absolutely incredible. The Germans blew the propaganda war right from the very first day. The very first town that they attacked was a little village inside of Luxembourg called Trois Virgins. So you can imagine the headlines all over the world. Entire German army attacks three virgins. Well, they came marching through, and the French response was not to meet them, because the French had come up with another plan that they called Plan 17.
Okay.
Their general, Joffre, had come up with this. And his idea was to let the northern part open, because certainly the Germans wouldn't march through neutral Belgium, and instead come down through Alsace, Lorraine, cross the Rhine, all the way through Germany and take Berlin. He never got anywhere. They didn't get a couple miles into the plan, and it fell apart. So it was just an absolute mess on the part of the French. The Germans were being very successful. By the way, when they went into Belgium, the English said, okay, that's it. We're not going to stand for this. And they then sent the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, into Belgium to help the Belgians.
Okay.
The Belgians figured that they could hold out for quite a while because they had two fortresses that you could not get around. You had to go through them. And these were the latest. They were the most modern, sophisticated defense fortresses that Europe had. And one of them was at the city of Liège, and the other one was at the city of Namur. And they told the Allies they could hold out for months. And that would give Joffre the time to turn the army around. They fell within a week.
Oh, my gosh.
And the reason was the Germans brought in these giant cannon and just blew them away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so as they're marching, it turns out that the Russians moved faster than they expected. Mm-hmm. And so they had to then, as they're marching through Belgium and heading down into France itself, they had to take several divisions and turn them around and send them all the way over to the Eastern Front to defend Berlin from the Russians. And by doing that, it weakened the attack, this hard right flank. And so instead of coming around and enveloping Paris, it actually came down on the east side of Paris. And so the whole object of the attack was lost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. While this is happening, the clash of great armies, the English, the Germans, the French, the Russians, the Germans, Pope Pius X died.
Mm-hmm.
He died on August 20th, 1914, just as these armies were about to grapple with each other. By the way, I should mention, too, that the Italians got out of the Triple Alliance because it was a defensive treaty. And had the Germans been attacked, then they would have been obliged to defend.
Okay.
But since it was an aggressive move on the part of the Germans and the Austrians, they then refused to join in. They were neutral for a short while and then threw their lot in with the Western Allies, with Britain, France, and then, of course, Russia. On the 1st of September 1914, the conclave was held in the Vatican to elect a new pope. And of the 65 cardinals, only 57 of them were able to make it. Some of them obviously were detained because of the war. And so the ballots then that went on, there were 10 ballots over a 3-day period. And they very quickly coalesced around a potential pope. He was the Archbishop of Bologna. He had great credentials. He was of noble birth, going back many, many centuries on both sides of his family. He had quite a pedigree. He was also a trained diplomat, so all of these things were definitely going for him. His name is Giacomo della Chiesa, and he had a nickname around the Vatican. They called him the Little One, because he was very short and very, very skinny. Just a real diminutive fellow, not in good health. Okay. But nonetheless, he's elected and chooses the title Benedict the 15th. He sets the coronation to take place 3 days later. So it's a very, very rapid. I mean, you know, he's elected, he's coronated, and it's going to happen 3 days later in the Sistine Chapel, not in St. Peter's. This meant, of course, that there would not be a huge crowd. It's basically just the cardinals and certain dignitaries. And afterwards, rather than having a big banquet, there was just a little simple reception. And he chose that all of himself. Hmm. He wanted this to be low-key. And so it was. And within that 3-day period of time, he chose Cardinal Ferrata as his Secretary of State. It's an interesting move because Cardinal Ferrata was known to be pro-French. At the same time, of course, he did not renew the other Secretary of State, Mary Duval, who was obviously very close to the French. And interesting things flow out of all of this. But one of the cardinals recognized the brilliance in this particular move of choosing this particular cardinal and said the following. This little quote I came across. He said, "My goodness, we have already a professed pope, not a novice." So this guy hit the ground running and was making very important decisions right from the very beginning. Let me say something about his family background, because you'd have to say that he had the genetic hardware to do the job. You know, on his father's side, his father was a marquis, and a long line of ancestors, long pedigree, including a pope in the family.
Oh, wow.
This goes back way to the 1100s, but Pope Calixtus II is one of his ancestors. That's interesting, because Calixtus II is the one who spent most of his papacy trying to induce the rest of Europe to accept the concept of the truce of God. Isn't that interesting?
Uh-huh.
You know, trying to keep the warring factions from warring during the holy days and during Sundays. He's probably best known for the Concordat of Worms, in which he met with the Holy Roman Emperor. And at that time, civil authority was submitted. The emperor recognized the pope as being superior in questions of faith and morals. So here, you know, it's like here you have someone in the 11th century, or 12th century, who is able to convince the leaders, the civil leaders, to listen to him. One would hope that they would do the same thing with Benedict.
Yeah.
That's on his father's side. On his mother's side, there's another pope.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that something? Yeah, as you trace back, she's also from noble family, and you trace her family back, she had an ancestor who was Innocent the VII. Now, he was only a pope for 2 years, from 1404 to 1406. And he was a compromise candidate because there were two families that were vying for the papacy at the time, the Orsini family and the
Corleone.
Well, the Colonna.
The Colonna, yeah. That's right. The Corleone. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
Yes.
As I say, he was a compromise candidate, died 2 years later. But what's interesting about him is that he had been the Archbishop of Bologna.
Oh my God.
Which, of course,
that's where he came from.
That's, yeah, Dolciesa came from the same
oh,
spot.
Wow.
Well, Giacomo della Chiesa was born in November of 1854.
Okay.
And went to school, got a law degree in 1875. So he's moving right along there, ordained to the priesthood in 1878, and almost immediately was brought to Rome through the efforts of Cardinal Rampolla.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, he's the mm-hmm. Secretary of State for Pope Leo XIII. He saw him as being very valuable in the diplomatic corps. And so he became the secretary to Cardinal Rampolla. And then eventually, in 1901, became the Deputy Secretary of State
wow.
to the Cardinal, even getting the position of going to Vienna as the nuncio. I mean, that's big stuff, you know. So he was certainly on a career path in the in the Vatican. And of course, Pope Leo died in 1903, and he was succeeded by Pope Pius X, who had other ideas for Monsignor della Chiesa, and he sent him off to become the Archbishop of Bologna.
Okay.
Well, a lot of people in the Vatican consider this to be an exile.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the other hand, it also gave him practical pastoral experience that he would not have had otherwise. And in fact, if there's any rumors of animosity between the two men, it was proved obviously false, because in 1914, in May, Pope Pius X made him a cardinal. Interestingly enough, it's only 3 months before his own death, before Pius X's death. Obviously, his greatest task is going to be the war, to bring an end to this war. There are millions and millions of people affected by this, and certainly it's bleeding Christendom. You have a Catholic nation, France, Catholic nation, Belgium, half-Catholic nation, Germany, Catholic Empire, the Austrian Empire. So many Catholics are caught up in this. Even if you just looked at this, even if Benedict just looked at this solely from a denominational point of view, it's a terrible tragedy for the Church. But when you start looking at it from a Christian view, the whole of Christendom, it looks like suicide.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he eventually calls it that. On the 8th of September, 1914, we're talking about days after his election, in his first address to the world, he called this war the scourge of the wrath of God, and called upon all the nations to step back from that wrath, that they could do that. And obviously no one listened to him. While he was making that speech, as he was assuming office, there was a battle that took place in which literally hundreds of thousands of men were involved. This is called the First Battle of the Marne. It's the Marne River. And as I said before, the German army that was coming down, that was supposed to sweep across the coast of the North Sea and then descend down on Paris and circle it, had come down instead over onto the other side of it, onto the east side of the city. But it was still a huge fist. And as it was coming down, the object now had changed. Instead of the object being the capital of France, it now became the French army itself.
Hmm.
Marshal Joffre had realized his mistake in Plan 17, and what he did was he turned his entire army facing northward and marched it up and hit the German army even as it was coming down. The Germans crossed over the Marne River, and they met with fierce resistance by the French. And then they fell back over to the other side of the Marne River. The French then came up, and they met with fierce resistance from the Germans. And so a give and take took place. There would be no quick German victory as a result. The war would go on. and there would be no easy solution on how to end this war. But in this one battle alone, just on the Allied side, and we're talking mainly French, but also some of the British and Belgian troops that had been swept in front of the Germans. I mean, they literally had been swept away by this huge army. That they suffered, just the Allies suffered 140,000 casualties, dead, wounded, and captured,
oh
in 39 days of fighting. 140,000 casualties. The German army had been so, had moved so quickly as a juggernaut that they didn't even have time to set up bivouacs and set up feeding stations. They literally had carts and trucks in which the cooks, they had mobile kitchens in which they were cooking for the troops as they moved. They couldn't even keep up with communications. They couldn't lay cable fast enough to be able to send telegraphs back and forth. It was this quick. This movement was this quick and this massive. And what happened is then that the Germans are not able to push the French back. The French are not able to push the Germans back. And slowly, well, rapidly, actually, over just a couple days, they began digging trenches into the ground. And then there would be attacks over to the left and to the right, trying to outflank. And every time an attack took place on the flank, the trenches grew more and more. And they went all the way. I mean, it was one of the great feats of civil engineering, in a sense. These trenches, a dual set of trenches, went all the way from central France all the way to the North Sea, where you couldn't dig anymore because you know the water would come up. And then in the other direction, all the way down to the Alps Mountains.
Oh, my gosh.
Which was, of course, so rugged you couldn't dig either. So there was this huge two ribbons, and then in between, of course, no man's land. What caused all of this was not only the huge numbers of men involved, but it also involved new weaponry that had been developing throughout the 19th century and now really finds itself being applied. First of all, you've got a rapid-fire field gun that the French had invented. The 75, it was called the 75, the 75. It was a 75-millimeter gun that used a shell. Now, the old way of, I'm going to do a little military history here, but the old way of firing a cannon, of course, was to put a charge in a smoothbore barrel, and then you put your projectile in, and you fire the darn thing off, and it goes off, and it maybe hits where you want to go. But then there's also a recoil on the gun so that the gun is forced back several feet. And then the artillerymen have to bring the gun back up, try to get it at the same spot, which is probably impossible, in order to fire off again and try again. With these guns, the 75s, and then the Germans will have their own. It's a 77-millimeter. What they did was they placed them on carriages, but they had on both sides of the cannon itself, they had these tubes and with compressed air so that they would absorb the pressure of the recoil and the gun would go back exactly where it had been before. Also, they had improved metallurgy and machine tooling by this time, and so they were able to actually open the back end of the cannon up. It's called a breech-loading gun, and so you could throw a shell in much faster than you could otherwise, so much so that you could fire one of these guns between 6 to 25 rounds a minute.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that something?
That is.
You know, and you're firing off some pretty high explosives. So with all of those things, the lethality of a battlefield is just really increased. So that's one thing. Another thing is the invention of really big guns, and especially the Germans are the ones who are going to make use of this. They have an ironwork called the Krupp Company. They're pretty infamous throughout the First and Second World War, building armaments. But the Krupp people had been working on building or making high-class cylinders which of course that's basically what a gun is, for some while, and they had developed, and then also another company that was actually in Bohemia, so it's Austro-Hungarian, called Skoda, had also been playing around with this, and both of them had come up with these absolutely huge mortars. The Skoda Works had developed a 305 millimeter mortar. We're talking, you know, what, it's, two and a half, 3 feet wide. The hole that this thing is fired out of, it fired an 800-pound shell.
Oh, my gosh.
And the Krupp people, of course, they weren't going to be outdone by a bunch of Bohemians, so they turned around. They built a one bigger than that, a 420-millimeter cannon that fired a shell that weighed 2,100 pounds. This is like firing a small automobile.
Oh, my gosh.
And, of course, the Allies thought this was absolutely ridiculous because the thing was so big, you can't
move it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would be of no use to anybody except maybe putting it on the coast so that they could fire at ships going by or something like that. It's of no use. Well, what they didn't realize was that when the Krupp people built this gun, and ultimately the biggest gun they're going to build, they named after the wife of the owner of the company, a gal by the name of Bertha.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm not kidding. This is the big Bertha. What they did was they built it in such a way that it was, you could take it apart.
Oh, you could take it apart.
Yeah, so they dismantled it.
Oh.
They sent it by rail to where they wanted, and then they reassembled it, and then they would fire it on a rail, on railway. And there was no way of stopping the recoil on this. So what happened was they would fire this thing off, and it would take off. The cannon would take off down the tracks. And then when it would stop, you'd get a locomotive and pull it back to
the
position.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
It was that bad. This thing could fire over 20 miles. And it was used to bring terror to cities in France.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rem was hit by this cannon, and just luckily the cathedral was uninjured. The city of Paris also, when the Germans got within range of Paris, they brought Big Bertha up to terrorize the people of Paris. Much more lethal than these two, though. I mean, you know, you got a big shell coming at you like that. And that's, of course, what reduced the fortresses at at Liège and Namur. But more individual was the rifle itself. And there have been a lot of changes in the rifle since the time of the American Revolution. I'm sorry, of the American Civil War. When we went into the American Civil War, think about this, in 1861, we basically used the same kind of weapons that Napoleon had used.
Mm-hmm.
It's called a fusilier, the Napoleonic fusilier, and it was a muzzle-loading gun. You could get off about 4 shots a minute. If you're really good, you could get off about 6, and it had a range of about 150 yards. Okay. By the end of the Civil War, you know, the American Civil War was an incredibly bloody affair. And part of it was due to the fact that both the North and the South continued using the same military tactics that they had learned back at West Point, because both sides had, of course, been trained at West Point. They used the same tactics, but they had changed weapons by then.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the North, they had introduced something known as the Zouave rifled musket. And once again, you could get off about 4 to 6 shots a minute. But this was rifled so that the projectile, when it would come in, when it was coming out, would be spinning. And that gives it a flatter trajectory. And the range then had gone up from 150 to 250 yards. Years and years ago, I did a little experiment with a bunch of high school kids, and we went out to a football field, and they were all into this military stuff, military history, and the Civil War. They were real big buffs on that, and so I had half of them go on one side of the football field and half on the other side, and so it's 100 yards basically, and. So anyway, I said, okay, now, you two have both set off, you've both fired. Now, I want this side over here on the left to go through the process of reloading. So I had a stopwatch, and I said, you've got 15 seconds to reload. And when you have reloaded, shout out, fire. Okay? Now, this side over here, you have just fixed bayonets. You've got 15 seconds to run from one side of the football field to the other side of the football field and go stab. You know? And so we did it.
Uh-huh.
And you know what? Those guys could not reload fast enough. You know, because it doesn't take 15 seconds to run from one side of a football field to another. But then I had them go ahead and pace off another 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're at 200. And I said, okay, same rules, let's do it again. Well, sure enough,
it changes
everything. Yeah, so the defense is given the advantage then. Well, now, if that's enough, that 100 yards, consider the rifle that was used in World War I. Okay, this is the best-known rifle was the Enfield, a British rifle. It had a range of 1,000 yards.
Oh, my gosh.
Nobody charging has any chance at all. No chance. And besides that, a good rifleman could get off 15 shots a minute. 15
wow.
shots a minute. The battlefield is absolutely, utterly deadly.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets worse,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's yet another weapon that has been introduced that is actually, I hate to use this term, but it's the queen of the battlefield, and that's the machine gun.
Oh, yeah.
You know, 90% of all the casualties that take place in no man's land is caused by the machine gun. These were just absolutely incredible. The stellar machine gun in this whole group was the Maxim. It was invented in 1889, and once again, the British introduced it, 600 rounds a minute.
Oh, my gosh.
You didn't aim at anybody. You just sprayed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. War.
Isn't that something?
That's the horrible thoughts to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the lethality of this is just it's just overwhelming. In one standing contest in the area around Champaign, the area of Rheims, the Champaign district, the French had counterattacked the Germans. Now, the Germans were caught off guard. They only had 150,000 men, only. But the French attacked with 500,000 men. A half million. Can you imagine
wow.
that? A half million men.
Wow.
And they came across the fields. First of all, what they did was they bombarded the German lines for 3 days, lobbing shells into the German lines for 3 whole days. And at the end of the 3 days, a half million men came across the fields to attack what was left of the Germans. And it just goes to show you the resiliency of a human being to withstand this tremendous bombardment, because almost immediately after the bombardment stopped, the Germans came out of tunnels and holes and everything else they'd been hiding in. They set up their machine guns to receive the French, and this terrible battle went on for days. In the end, the Germans had 25,000 casualties, dead, wounded, and captured. 25,000 casualties. The French had 145,000.
Wow.
6-1. And this is all due to the trench warfare and the machine guns.
Mm-hmm.
And neither side had any idea of how to bring this thing to an end. It was just a human slaughter. By Christmas of 1916, in the Christmas message that Pope Benedict had to the world, he called the world, and I quote here, a hospital and a cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
This was the year, 1916 was the year of the Battle of Verdun, and it absolutely shows the truth in what he was talking about. This was invented, the battle itself actually was designed by a German general by the name of von Falkenhayn. And he called it a battle of annihilation.
Mm.
And what he did was he looked all up and down the battlefield for one spot that the French would defend regardless. They would never allow this to fall. And he decided that the place was the old medieval ancient city of Verdun. And so he was going to then pour all kinds of attacks onto Verdun, and the French would come in and defend it. The Germans actually had it surrounded on three sides. And so they brought in 1,400 pieces of artillery and began bombarding the French position there. And it went on for 40 days, day and night, bombings, day and night. And the French just kept on sending more and more men in as this bombardment took place. The French commander, by this time Joffre had been kicked out, he's replaced by Marshal Foch, who becomes the supreme Allied commander. And his one response was, "Ils ne passeront pas." They shall not pass. They're not going to come through here. And so much so that as many as 90,000 French a week were sent into this grinder, this meat grinder. Well, what happened was the Germans ended up falling into the trap also.
Mm-hmm.
The idea, Falkenhayn's idea, was to have a spot where the French would simply send men in so that the Germans could kill them. But after this went on for months, people in the royal family back in Berlin and the German people were saying, "What about this Battle of Verdun? Why aren't we winning it?" And so Falkenhayn had to change his strategy to try to take it himself. And as a result, he ended up losing massive amounts of Germans also. This battle went on for 327 days.
Oh, my gosh.
Almost a year. And by the time it was over, there were over 700,000 casualties in this one battle.
Wow.
I visited the battlefield at Verdun. It is a sobering experience. You look out over fields and it looks like snow. The crosses are strewn all over. Literally hundreds of thousands. The battlefield itself is considered to be the bloodiest soil on the face of the earth. The battlefield itself, you would have to dig down, I think they told me, 10 feet before you could get the virgin soil. All of that 10 feet is soil that is churned over with weapons, with parts of weapons, with parts of human beings that were not retrieved. After the battle was over, the French went through and grabbed as many identifiable corpses as possible and brought them back to one spot, a hill. And they built a memorial there called the Wasserie, literally the bonery. And I saw photographs of this at the end of the war, just huge mounds of skeletons. And these are now interned into the Wasserie, which is a war memorial. And you look down into the cellar, and there are windows all throughout. And you look down, and you can see nothing but piles of skeletal bones.
Mm.
And this goes on. This is like a 100-yard building. And I found out later that the Wasserie itself is 3 feet deep.
Oh.
So it's just absolutely horrible. And as I say, you know, nobody's listening to the Pope in this. They're just throwing human beings away. Another battle taking place simultaneously from July to October of 1916, the Battle of the Somme. There, huge casualties. The Germans alone suffered 500,000 casualties. Dead, wounded, and captured. 500,000. The British, 400,000. The French, 200,000. Pope Benedict XV referred to this as the suicide of civilized Europe.
Yes.
You know, in another one of his addresses, he said it was the darkest tragedy of human hatred and human madness. He refused to take sides. And as a result of that, he was castigated, and mainly by the Allies, because they thought that he was supposed to be on their side.
Mm-hmm.
One of his greatest critics was the leader of France at the time. His name is Georges Clemenceau, and this man was rabid toward war, first of all, he's a secularist. He's part of the Red France, and has such a hatred for the Pope, that he refers to him as Le Pape Bosch, the German Pope. Mm-hmm. Or actually not, the Bosch doesn't mean German in French, it means like Kraut, mm-hmm. the Kraut Pope, mm-hmm. you know, as derogatory as can be. Interestingly enough, I have a collection, it's a rather rare collection of a 1920, a volume called The Story of the Great War. And it's 8 volumes long. It's 4,000 pages.
Wow.
It's a 4,000 page. It's the diplomatic edition of this story of World War I. It was put together immediately after the war. Okay, 4,000 pages. I went to look up Pope Benedict the 15th. There are only 2 pages in the entire thing that even said his name. And it was a little article about President Wilson visiting the Pope at a ceremony after the war was finished, before the League of before the Versailles Treaty was formed. Isn't that something? I mean, he was totally ignored, certainly by the West. His whole idea was to bring about an end to this war, mm-hmm. and not with capitulation, one side or another, but rather negotiation. Benedict, I mean, this is a man whose life was spent in diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And he knew that if this war, as terrible as it was, with millions of these casualties, if it came to one side winning, the other side losing, that it would be a vindictive victory, which would set the 20th century onto a terrible path
right.
of reprisal. In fact, that same sense of reprisal is already planted in the French politicians after 1870. If you wanted to get people standing and with a big ovation at the end of a political rally, the one thing you said, there were 2 words you could use. One word was revanche, and the other one was encore, again. You know, okay, you beat us this first time, we'll get you the next one. So that was what was motivating French politics in the 40-something, 45 years leading up to this war. And that kind of hatred had to be put aside. The Pope understood that, and he was powerless to do that. There's a lot that he did, though.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things he did was he set up a Vatican office known as the Office for Prisoners. And this was a sort of a clearinghouse for information. And how he did this was, it was very clever. He had the Office for Prisoners set up in the Vatican itself, and then contacts made to every diocese in all of the countries that were involved in belligerency. All the dioceses, all the nunciatures, and what happened was that families could then go to the local diocese and get information on their loved one.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. Let's say that you had a young man from St. Louis here that went over to France, and he disappeared. He's now a POW. Okay, or we don't know what happened to him. You know, he's missing in action. And the family then would go to the diocese here in St. Louis, to Cardinal Glennon, and they would say, we don't know what happened to Johnny. And then Bishop Glennon would then relay that information to the Vatican, to the Office of Prisoners, who would then contact the church in Germany, where the various POW camps were, and they would search through the camps to find Johnny. And then word would be brought back through the Vatican to St. Louis, to the Archdiocese, who would then contact the family and say, your son's safe,
here.
He lost an arm, but he's safe, he's in a camp in Germany. Isn't this phenomenal?
Wow, yeah.
You know, displaced persons, the whole works. And so this is one of the great things he was able to do. By the time the Office for Prisoners was eventually abolished at the end of the war, they had processed 700,000 information requests.
Wow.
And also succeeded in repatriating 40,000 people. Many of them were Italians who had been caught up in the war, and they were able to make negotiations to have the Italian POWs and civilians returned back to Italy. But 40,000 people were able to be repatriated
wow.
as a result of this one office, and then another 700,000 were to receive information about their loved ones. Not only that, but between 1917 and 1918, Pope Benedict literally took Vatican funds and had them shipped to the East to be able to help Russian peasants feed themselves during the Russian Revolution. there was a famine, of course, during the Bolshevik Revolution, and he did that. In 1921, he found out that in China, there was a terrible disruption, and millions of Chinese were starving, and money was sent over to China to buy food to help the people there. This is also, I should mention, is also the year of the pandemic, 1918-1919, in which the influenza epidemic spread. It's estimated that we have no way of actually knowing how many people, but somewhere between 20 million and 40 million people died in this epidemic, and it was worldwide. Don't want to give anybody the willies, but an interesting point is that if you go back to the prophecies of St. Malachi,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, the 104th Pope in his list is designated as Religio Depopulata, the depopulated religion. There is one final attempt that Benedict makes to bring about the end of the war, and he puts forth a papal peace plan. Okay? His hope was that since neither side would negotiate with the other, maybe both sides would listen to reason and sign on to this plan. First of all, was a guarantee of the freedom of the seas, that every nation would be able to use the seas freely. This is significant. This is the number one reason why the United States went to war in 1917,
mm-hmm.
because some of our ships had been sunk. One of the most famous, of course, was actually a British ship with Americans on it, the Lusitania. But by 1917, 1918, the Germans were sinking so much tonnage. In fact, in 1 month, they actually sunk 875,000 tons of ships. And that's a lot of loss of life besides material. And interestingly enough, their propaganda ministry had no idea how much they were sinking. And so they set out the propaganda claiming that they were sinking 600,000 tons. Actually, 800,000. That was the first thing in the papal peace plan, was that there would be open seas, freedom of the seas. Secondly, a gradual disarmament of the nations, that the war would be brought to an end, and that the nations would voluntarily begin a disarmament, especially from the greatest of weapons. I should mention also that by this time, we truly do have weapons of mass destruction invented. For one thing, the use of poisonous gases. And then thirdly, the third part of the papal peace plan was to establish an international arbitration tribunal, some kind of international agency that would oversee disputes in the future. Any chance that the Allied side would even talk to the Pope about this was dashed in 1917 when the United States came in on the war. Now they figured, with the Americans on their side, that they would have plenty of men and materiel to bring this war to a successful conclusion. And so the Allies were going for broke. They intended to win. So they rejected the Pope's plan. Mm-hmm. On the German side, they had fully considered it. They wanted to know the elements of it. They were entered into conversation with the Vatican concerning this. They were, at least at the beginning, they were sincere. And part of the reason for this was that the Vatican had a papal nuncio in Bavaria who spoke German fluently and had a great love for the German people, and the people had a great love for him, and so he had easy access to German diplomats. His name is Eugenio Pacelli.
Ah, okay.
Isn't that interesting?
Uh-huh.
But what happened was that the German generals got the Kaiser aside and said, look, don't blow it now. We can win this thing. Mm-hmm. All we have to do is keep on sinking ships, and we've got a plan in 1918. We'll be able to destroy the Allies before the Americans arrive. And the Emperor of Germany, the Kaiser Wilhelm II, goes, let's go for it. I'm for Mars. And so he went for the God of War instead of going for the peace plan. The only one that actually seriously wanted this plan was the Austro-Hungarian Empire. By now, the Franz Joseph has died.
Yeah.
He is succeeded to the throne by a very young and very devout Catholic, Charles, who becomes Emperor Charles IV of the Austrian Empire. He really wants to negotiate peace, and since Germany won't go along with it, and Russia's out of the war with the Communist Revolution, and France won't go along, Britain won't go along, he tries to use the Vatican to enter as an intermediary with Italy. Mm-hmm. And at least those two countries would leave the war. The Italians wouldn't even talk to him. They were land hungry, and they thought that if they stayed with the Allies and the Allies won, that they could get some Austrian land, mm-hmm. which is in fact exactly what they ended up getting. Mm-hmm. The war drug on until November 11th, 1918. And finally, at that point, both sides signed an armistice. In other words, they would simply stop fighting. It was not a peace treaty, but it led ultimately to the Treaty of Versailles, which Benedict, one of the greatest diplomats in Europe, one of the the one guy that could probably come up with a true treaty that would be a foundation, mm-hmm. For peace, was not even invited, was not even consulted. The only thing that he did was he was at a ceremony in Rome when President Wilson went through. That was it.
Wow.
And when he read the peace treaty, he shook his head and he said, "This is," and I quote here, "a consecration of hatred." Marshal Foch, when he read the treaty, he rather prophetically said, "This is not peace. It is a truce for 20 years." Mm-hmm. That was in 1919. September 1st, 1939, 20 years later, the world went into World War II.
Well, Father, we've run out of time, but man, what an incredible,
it's sad.
Horrible
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, looking at these numbers and the lives that are lost.
Yeah.
How horrendous. And
other things are happening, too. I mean, the Bolshevik Revolution is tearing Russia apart and ultimately giving Eastern Europe to godless communism, mm-hmm. which is going to spread and be a scourge on the world in the mid-20th century. Then the pandemic, another tens of millions of people dying from disease.
Yeah.
Also, so this is really a horrible time, and I guess this is a good setup for us for our next meeting, because it's during all of this that mm-hmm. we have the apparition at Fatima, and Mary again gives us an opportunity to turn away from this century, which of course we don't do.
All right. Well, that will be a nice look next week.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Father. Shall we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Okay. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Thank you, Father.
Okay.